Welcome to Confab on a Thursday evening. You're listening to a people-powered radio station, 2XXFM 98.3. We're a community radio in Canberra, streaming online and on demand on 2XXFM.org.au. Now, I'm going to introduce Canberra to an artisan, a chocolatier, in fact, which is an interesting thing you mightn't find here in Australia, but if you're in France, and in Paris in particular, or in Belgium, you'll see a wonderful chocolatier shops around the place, and they're very special artisans. But before we kick off the conversation today, we're going to play a track from the Black Keys. To welcome people out there in Canberra and the local community to an individual who, if you haven't met him or seen him or visited his wonderful establishment, Stu is an artisan who creates wonderful chocolate delights from cacao beans and other ingredients, and he is what I would classify in Canberra a chocolatier, a unique individual, because there's not many of them in the Canberra region. Welcome to the studio, Stu.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
It is a pleasure, sir. Now, you picked a track from Black Keys, and you mentioned before we kicked off the conversation today that has a special significance, the track that we've just played.
Yeah, the track itself, I mean, the band as well, is one of those bands that I've been listening to for quite some time now. And funny enough, my wife got me onto them originally a few years, or probably close to 10 years back now. But yeah, it's just one of those ones, you know, got upbeat to them. There's only two members of the band, so, you know, what they produce is, you know, quite profound. They do really good work, so really love listening to them. Any kind of track really just, you know, reminds me of, you know, things past and what's in the future as well. And I really enjoy that track. It's even the film clip as well, if you get a chance to have a look on YouTube. It's got a bit of humor to it, which is really good. So yeah, it's just one of those ones that every time I put it on kind of gives me, you know, a bit of a boost to keep going. Particularly, when I'm working away in the chocolate shop.
The chocolate shop. So that wasn't a track that you might have listened to early on in your career, or is it something that's evolved over a period of time?
Well, it's evolved because, I mean, even with the band itself, like, you know, relatively, I say, new, introduced, particularly I've been working now, coming up 20 years since I started my apprenticeship as a chef. So, you know, it's like you do get introduced to new bands, even though those guys have been around for quite some time. So, yeah, relatively new still, but at the same token, you know, they always, you know, there's something about them that every time you hear them, you know, you can sing along, whistle along, kind of keeps you going.
This is a question I ask a lot of people. There, are you a local lad, or someone who's come to Canberra with your parents, mum and dad?
No, I'm definitely not local. I was born in the UK, but I was two when my parents and I immigrated over here to Australia. We spent a couple of years in Sydney as my mum was working as a nurse there. And then they found an opportunity, or were told about a place up north called Nelson Bay. Or Port Stephens. So they went up and had a look, and they ended up actually on the other peninsula close to Nelson Bay, called Tillagerry Peninsula, and they ended up at a place called Lemon Tree Passage. So that's right on the end of the Tillagerry Peninsula there. They, you know, built a house. That's where I essentially grew up since the age of four. And yeah, started going to school closer to Newcastle, particularly high school was Newcastle area. So my kind of first real taste or experience of Canberra is when I was a fourth year apprentice chef. We come down for a showcase. I was involved in a hospitality training network. So that's who I did my apprenticeship through. Every year they did a showcase of apprentice skills. And that year it was held, 2000, it was held at the CIT here. And it was just pretty much probably kind of think how many kids there were. I think there's about 20 or so apprentices ranging from second year up to fourth year. And the idea was they would get them together. They would create a menu. You would have, you know, a sous chef and a head chef being the apprentices still, and then everyone working in their sections. And the idea was the menu would be created. It'd be generally, I think, a 3-course meal, and all the apprentices would put that all together, serve it all up that night. And you'd also have, you know, apprentice, all the waiters as well. They're all young, going through their training as well. So the first taste of Canberra was when I was 18, mm-hmm. down here. We come to CIT, and to be honest, it wasn't, you know, didn't really strike me as being the place to be.
Well, can I come back to that in a minute?
Of course.
I want to take you back to Lemon Tree.
Yep.
And take you back. So your mum and dad were English.
Yes.
And in your formative years, did you ever go back to England on holidays to visit your relatives? Or?
No, I had my dad's mum and dad. They came over for a visit when we first moved down to Lemon Tree area. Mm-hmm. So that would have been 89. Mm-hmm. So they came and visited a few times, actually. The first time we actually went back all together as a family, it was only my mum, my dad and myself. We went back there in 98.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a while after. I was almost 13 at the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was the first time that we'd actually gone back to the UK and, you know, actually met most of my family, because I'd never really seen them, or, you know, we spoke and things like that. But even with, you know, technology, it was a landline call. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have Skype, you didn't have anything like that. So, I mean, yeah, it was very different. Like, you know, talk to my grandparents over the phone probably, you know, once a week, once a fortnight. My mum had family as well up in the middle of England. Dad's more down the south. So I spoke to them as well. And that was pretty much the interaction we had. But yeah, ended up going back when I was about 12 or 13. And then the next experience was when I was by myself. And that was just after I'd finished my apprenticeship.
Okay. So you're back there, and what were you? I mean, you're living in up at that. I think I've been to Lemon Tree myself. It's a very small.
Yeah, small very area. Small. Off the way.
Off the way.
You know, it's like Kuala Capital of Port Stephens, and okay. It's very, yeah, it's very quiet. It's like a smaller. It's a smaller community in a style. Mm-hmm. The peninsula is broken up. It was Tanilba, Malabula, and Lemon Tree Passage. Malabula was in the middle of the two, very small as well, and then Tanilba Bay, which was the larger kind of, you know, more. Yeah, occupied area that had, you know, the supermarket and things like that. So that was, you know,
That was the place. So when you went then back to England, what impressions did you get of England when you went back for that holiday?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite different. I mean, we stayed mainly with my dad's sister and brother-in-law. So they were just out of London, so probably 20-minute train journey southeast of London. But still, like, yeah, very different, I suppose. Like anything, you go to another country, it's like different TV shows, you know, different shopping, you know, shopping centres, or even with, like, you know, say, you know, Tesco versus Woolworths or Bilo, which it was called back then instead, yeah, of Coles and things, yeah, like that. So, yeah, yeah, it was just, you know, completely different experience. And even with hanging out with my cousins and, like, the way that they were growing up compared to, you know, English versus Australian, in the sense of just anything, really. You know, they always think that you go to school in a pouch of a kangaroo and things, yeah, like this. So,
yeah, I was just trying to get at it in a sense of your mum and dad decided to come to Australia. And then you were brought up in Lemon Tree, as you said, a very small area, koala capital of Australia. And then you would think, what sort of – then what impression – or if you'd stayed in England versus coming to Australia, how do you think that might have moulded or given you a slightly different direction in your life or life choices perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, it would have changed, I suppose, quite a bit. Like, you know, seeing how my cousins or a couple of my cousins have grown up, what choices they've kind of taken as well. Like, you know, it's very still in the trade, like, you know, doing trade work and things like that. I mean, with growing up with my parents, my mum was a registered nurse. Dad was kind of like he could do anything. Like, he can build anything, fix anything. So he kind of had jobs in like joineries. I think one of the earliest memories is he used to cement render water tanks. You know, so things like that. But he could do, he could build anything, he could fix, he could, with his cars, anything like that, he knew it all. So I grew up a lot with that working kind of mentality. So it was kind of like, you know, you get yourself a job, it didn't matter, kind of, not so much, as long as you enjoyed it, as long as it's something that you wanted to do. My parents always instilled that, you know, as long as you enjoy it and it's what you want to do, then you go for it. So for me, you know, in more of an educational sense, I got to a point when I was about 8 or so, it's like I knew I wanted to be a chef.
Right. So, yeah, it's interesting. At that early age.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, I was introduced into, like, you know, some baking, cooking, that kind of thing, normally what kids do, you know, either on a weekend or school holidays and things. So I was introduced into getting into baking, like scones, cakes, that kind of stuff. Really loved looking at recipes, even flipping through, you know, magazines, or mum had, you know, the Women's Weekly cookbooks and things. So I remember at a younger age, like, you know, looking through the cake book and trying to pick a cake or something, and either mum or dad really trying their best to match it, sort of thing. Yeah. And even now I remember dad trying to make like an eclair, but in the shape of, I think it was a 5 for my 5th birthday, and he was following this recipe, but for whatever he did, it just didn't work out right. And now I can remember why it wouldn't work, because I've learnt how to do it myself. Back then I remember him trying, and like, yeah, the end result was still great, but it's just having that, you know, instilled. It's like I enjoyed baking. I enjoyed that kind of mixing ingredients, weighing ingredients, that kind of thing, and then having the outcome of like a biscuit or a cake or something that could be enjoyed. Yeah. So that was another kind of very strong memory, and that's now, kind of what just influenced me.
Now, excuse my ignorance. That's okay. Lemon Tree, New South Wales or Queensland?
New South Wales.
Okay. So if you're at you're at school, yep. And I don't think home economics was something that boys would generally –
High school. I chose in year 9 and 10. I chose food tech because I was already interested. That's what I already had my mindset that I wanted to be a chef. So like, you know, one of the avenues was just to do food tech, and that was one of the, all my other mates was doing woodwork or metalwork or whatever, and I was in there doing food tech with predominantly all girls, and it was just that, you know, still that kind of mentality. But it wasn't, there was never any kind of like, ah, oh, you're cooking, why are you cooking, you know, that belongs to a certain other. And it's like, no, it was just, you know, it was great because I could make stuff, and then, you know, you could give it to your friends afterwards, and they loved it. Right. So best of both worlds.
Yeah. And so you started that whole influence, so in a sense there was something. And your mum and dad, did they support you? Well, let's rephrase that. Given that you could actually get things to turn out properly and your dad couldn't, I'm assuming that your father would have been, go for it, Stu.
Yeah, it took a bit of time and effort. But, you know, as soon as I kind of told them what I wanted to do, they were completely supportive without doubt. So, that was always – that support mechanism was always there from them.
And then so we talk about – you just mentioned – so we're going around this circle now. We landed back to why – what influences were you? Probably a good thing your mum and dad came to Australia, because it gave you a different sense of direction. And,
definitely.
When I go back to England, it's gloom and doom. It really is a very gloomy.
It's got that feel to it.
Yeah. Some brilliant parts, lovely parts of pockets of the UK.
Oh, definitely.
That's brilliant. And other parts is just gloomy.
Well, my mum was very kind of mum, because she's more the old school England. She knows how she grew up, because she's a little bit older than my dad. So she kind of grew up in the sense of when it was like flourishing, and it was, and then kind of the way dad grew up was just more like, no, he just wants to get out of here, because like the weather and everything and all this kind of stuff. So he was keen to leave.
Yeah.
And mum's always had that sense of like, she'd always, not always just go back, but she has this memory of England, how it was, and she wants to, you know, she'd always love that. But dad was just like, no, Australia's great, good. That's weather, right. Beautiful. Yeah.
And I noticed too in England that there are pockets of brilliance. There are pockets of artisans. There are pockets of brilliance in design endeavor. However, when you then look at, say, in Australia's perspective, you'll find with a smaller population size, there are more of it.
Abundance of it, yeah, definitely.
And the choices, like Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra here. But over there, you know, you might find one extremely passionate pastry chef in a place like Milton Keynes, which I came across, one. And the rest of it was just bland and awful. Well, that's my view anyway. So hopefully no one there is listening to Milton Keynes, but anyway.
No, there's, and I suppose it depends wherever you go in the world because, yeah, you're always going to get, you know, things or places that seem a little bit kind of, dreary or which not. And then, you know, you've got others that are just bustling and full of life as well. So I know in the UK, when I went over there eventually to work, I was in London and, like, you know, there's, you're just constantly surrounded by a lot of influence and a lot of talent as well.
Yeah, we'll come to that shortly. Definitely. But anyway, so now we've got your study. So you went to, you studied there. And tell me a little bit now, you mentioned before that you came to Canberra with a group and you were doing some work at the CIT.
Yep.
Now, was that a local TAFE that you might have been working with, or how did that evolve?
Yeah, so it was a – I'm just trying to remember the name now. When I did my apprenticeship, I did it through a resort. And then – but the way it worked was I was actually doing my apprenticeship with a training network, but then what they do is they take on all the responsibility, but then, you know, you work for, you know, the place that you're at. So that's how it worked. But this training organization, they every year they did a showcase. So it was just, you know, it was kind of they chose X amount of apprentices that they had, you know, and they just wanted to put them all together in a kitchen. And it happened a few, like there was one in Newcastle because that's where I did my training at the TAFE there in Hamilton. But, you know, the CIT in here in Canberra, you know, they join up with a few of the local apprentices there as well. And, you know, we just all come together and we're kind of just working on dishes and working on sections and, you know, trying to get this meal up. I think it was emceed by John Blackman, you know, from Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Yeah.
He used to emcee them. So that was quite of an interesting evening, as you can imagine. It was it used to be filmed and things as well, and it was opened up, I think, to a lot of the industry, a lot of the, you know, host kind of trainers and things like that as well. So it was you know, really interesting. It took us, I think, 2 or 3 days to prepare for it, and then you had the evening as well, and then they would also that night they would give out they used to do a John Howard scholarship, which I actually took out in 2000.
Okay, is that John Howard the comedian or John Howard the politician?
No, it was it's John Howard. He's a I think he's a lot to do with the food industry more. Okay. He's come out with a few cookbooks and things like that. So yeah, it was actually kind of molded around for him.
Okay, so it's not the alter ego of John Howard the politician or John Howard the comedian. No. Well, we'll focus a little bit now on the non-chocolatier side of your
Howard.
Peter Howard.
My apologies. Peter Howard.
Well, all commiserations to John Howard, the politician, who probably can't cook anyway. He may be able to boil an egg. But anyway, influences around non-chocolatier work. So we'll come into the chocolatier in part two of conversation.
Yep.
Just before we get into that, are you the only chef in your family, in your extended family? Are you the only one that's taken that lovely journey?
Well, yes. With my immediate family, our ones in the UK and stuff like that as well. Like, yeah, I'm the only one. I know my grandma, my dad's side, she was a bit of a jack of all trades too, but I think back in her day she used to kind of work more with pastry and things, but never into a sense of like an establishment. I think it was always just like other factory work, things like that. But, you know, I think there was a lot of that kind of influence. There's not any kind of professional cooking or anything like that. So I'm kind of, that one that took on that.
Yeah, well, I'll just ask a question then. Sowing a seed for part two. Anyone in the family that's demonstrated some artistic endeavour?
My mum's very artistic. Mm-hmm. She loves, like, she can do, like, paintings, drawings, that kind of. She's always been very artistic in that regard. She can do a lot of those kind of things. She can work with lead lighting, folk art, paint on things, paint on canvas, paint on, you know, anything and everything. So she's always kind of had that art, you know, influence on me in a sense as well. But, and then, yeah, dad, on the other hand, of being able to build and create things, I think is another aspect of kind of, you know, being able to show an artist's side in a sense. Mm-hmm. Like still being able to use your creative brain to be able to create, like make things, particularly working with wood and stuff like that.
Now, in sort of summarizing not there yet to end up part one of our chat, is looking at, because you mentioned previously you've worked in London, but in a way, I suppose I'd like to understand the sort of style of restaurants that you've worked in, and have there been any influences? And this is non-chocolatier, so I'll come back to that one. And chefs that have really helped you in your direction, either from your skills or some of the life decisions that you've made. And when you see chefs on TV, sometimes you think, no, that wouldn't be wise to make life decisions based on what you see in the social media. But yeah, sort of give us a bit of an understanding of what you've experienced, where you've experienced it, and has it changed you?
Yeah, definitely. Well, when I was a first year, or when I did my full 4-year apprenticeship at a resort called Pepper's Anchorage, which is in Port Stephens there. It's Corlette, which is in between Nelson Bay and Salamander. So through school, work experience in 2000, I knew I wanted to be a chef. So kind of rang around or inquired a bit and found out that the restaurant there at the resort was probably one of the better restaurants going in the area or close by anyway. So, called them, got a work experience kind of week sorted, did my first week there in, I think it was June or July, spoke to the head chef who was a Frenchman, Jean-Marc, and kind of, queried him and spoke to him and said, look, I really, I want to finish my year 10 certificate, but then after that, I want to be a chef. So he was really supportive in that, started getting me back in just on weekend work after that work experience. So that was really good. I started to get to know the place, and on the second week of work experience, I think in about October or so, worked a week there again. And then after that, he offered me an apprenticeship. He said, I'd be happy to have you start in December after you finished your school certificate. So, I mean, that in an essence was a good start because, I started working in an environment, started getting to know the people and how it worked already. But then, for the 4 years working on the Jean-Marc, it was great. He was a very kind of traditional French chef, but still modernized as well because, a lot of influence, Asian influence. So there's a lot of that Australian-Asian kind of mix, but he also put a lot of French technique into his dishes as well. So got to learn, the real basics of making a pâté or a terrine, and then also working with some really kind of local ingredients or stronger ingredients and particularly Asian influenced as well. So after that, that kind of whole experience, particularly when I was only 15 when I started. So 19 when I qualified. And then after that, I just took a bit of time off. I got the scholarship, the Peter Howard scholarship. So that actually entitled me to go over to the UK. I went over to London, ended up doing a stage at a restaurant called the Ledbury, which is in Notting Hill. So Brett Graham, he's the chef there. He was a Newcastle or Novocastrian boy as well. And he kind of rise through the ranks. And I think he picked up Apprentice of the Year over in the UK at one stage as well. So that was a bit of an influence working there. A very big shock, I think, to me, because that was a proper Michelin star styled restaurant. From where I was back in, at the resort, we're in our own little bubble there. We're creating our own little things, which is fantastic. But I never really kind of experienced the more kind of, the hatted kind of restaurants that we have here in Australia. And then going over to the UK and then getting into this restaurant, which was properly sectioned up. And, you had all your meat section, your fish section, sauce section. And it was just go, go, go. It was a big shock to me. So it was it took me back a little bit. Plus, missing home and all that kind of stuff and still being quite young. So I ventured back into Australia. And then after that, I wound up at a one hat restaurant in the Bay called Zest Restaurant, which has since closed down. But I worked there for 4 years, Glenn and Jenny Thompson, who are the husband and wife team who owned it. And working with them, that started being more of a kind of, it became personal as well because they had a young family. They had a daughter and two sons who got along with really well. They were quite young, but was able to kind of do some babysitting here and there for them. And they used to have us for drinks at their house after shifts and things on a weekend. And it created a really nice environment. And it kind of showed you that you could actually get along with your bosses and things as well. And if you create a really good working environment, then the outcome is really good as well. That also kind of watching them work together, plus also the kids as well, it was kind of acted as a bit of contraception because you're like, oh, just having to have kids and stay was like, oh, it really kind of, yeah, yeah. it gave you different experiences, but they, you know, they were fantastic. So they were huge influences on me.
So in summary, one of the major lessons you learnt when you were over in the UK at the Michelin star, what was a less key thing that you learnt out of that experience?
I think out of that whole thing is like, what kind of position do you want to put yourself in? Cooking was something I always did because I loved it, and chefs over there, they do it because they love it too. But there's a different, like, you know, you're kind of putting yourself on the line every day, and, you know, your mental health can start changing, physical health as well, because, I mean, those places, like, you know, you're probably running 16-hour days easy, going in, no breaks, just getting it done, getting, like, because you're the high standard of food that's, you know, expected of you, and what people expect to come and, you know, they're paying for it, what they want. So, I mean, that was a huge kind of thing for me. It was like, do I really want to kind of not destroy myself, but do I really want to work myself into the ground and just kind of go down that route? Or because you hear of, like, you know, chefs going, you know, like, I used to go home and cry every evening and stuff, or every night I would cry because it was just so hard, and you get immense pressure. And I've still gone through that as well. Like, when, you know, I made it down to Melbourne and I worked there for 3 years, and I worked at a high-end restaurant there. And, you know, you put in the hours, you put in the time, but after all, it kind of, you seem like you're just on a wheel and you're just running and running and running. And it's like, unless you kind of, I think you branch off and you can kind of do your own thing or do it at your pace or do what you really, you know, because you can almost lose that love and passion for what you do. Mm-hmm. You can very easily just kind of dissipate and you're just there almost like a drone, just doing the same thing and just making sure that it works.
Okay. Well, Stu, before we go on further, that is going to be a great segue to our part two of our conversation. We're in conversation today with Stu, who is a brilliant artisan who creates wonderful chocolates, chocolate delights from cacao beans and other ingredients, an artisan, and what I should say is a chocolatier. And you're on the People Powered radio station 2XXFM 98.3, streaming online and on demand on 2XXFM.org.au. And before we go into part two of our conversation, we're going to listen to a track from the band Royal Blood called 10 Ton Skeleton. Now, why that track?
That track in particular, that's their debut album. This band, and they're a UK band, Royal Blood. Again, two piece band, one on drums, one on bass. But, you know, the bass player is also the lead singer, can kind of make the bass sound like a regular guitar as well. It's quite amazing to see. So the reason why I've chosen this band is they were up and coming when I was in the UK, when I was working in London at a chocolate shop there. So listening to them on the radio, so that kind of, you know, it reminds me of, you know, first listening to them, where I was at the time as well. But then at that time I was, you know, I was talking to my now partner, who I've known for years from the restaurant at Zest in the Bay. And I got, you know, introduced her to the band as well. So when I first come back to Australia and met up with her in Sydney, it was a day before they were playing their first ever gig in Australia. And it was in a small little venue in Sydney. So, you know, we met up in Sydney, we went and saw them for the very first time, and we've seen them 3 or 4 times since together. So this band itself is kind of very special in that regard. So.
Okay, so we'll play that track now.
No worries.
10 Ton Skeleton by Royal Band. Blood. Royal Blood. Get it right, Michael. Yeah. That track was 10 Ton Skeleton by Royal Blood. I got it right this time, Stu. I don't know why. My brain is in gear and my mouth is out of gear, but that's fine.
Having some ale of the time.
Yes. Now, before we played that track, you talked about passion. You'd also talked a bit about losing that passion about in being a chef. But you also then mentioned that you're working in a chocolate store in Melbourne?
No, in London. So
in London,
yeah. Before all that, So after working at the Hatted restaurant in the Bay, mm-hmm. with Glenn and Jen there, from there took a little bit of time off, did a bit of travelling with a mate of mine. So, you know, a bit through Asia, bit of Egypt, went and saw my family again in the UK. By that stage, my grandparents had moved to France. So it was nice to go and see them because they're out in the country there. It was, you know, beautiful part where they live. And then went through a bit of Canada and then back home. So by the time I got back home, I was gone for about 9 months or so. So I hadn't cooked anything, hadn't touched any food pretty much, just, you know, ate what was cooked for me and that was it. So coming back, I wound back up at the restaurant that I've been at for 4 years, at Zest there. And, you know, they were, you know, happy enough to have me back for a little bit, kind of hone my skills again, because it seemed like almost just completely, kind of completely lost, you know, a bit of, you know, my skill. But no, that was fantastic. And during that time, you know, the next stage for me was, all right, I want to move on. I want to actually kind of, you know, up it a little bit. I think, you know, I want to get back into a restaurant scene, but also kind of maybe a bit more fine dining. So I ended up getting a job down in Melbourne, working for the Vue du Monde Group. So they've got the Vue du Monde restaurant, which was a three-hat restaurant, but then also a few other venues around the area as well, a lot of cafes, like high-end kind of cafe style. So I ended up working down there for 2 years. And again, it was a great experience, particularly working in the three-hat restaurant. You know, I got myself onto pastry section because that's where I wanted to be. You know, I love cooking savory and getting into that, but I also love that more kind of, you know, strict kind of pastry, and also having to follow recipes correctly and making sure, you know, you weigh everything right or otherwise it won't work out. So I got involved on that section, and that was really good. But again, you know, that was kind of, you know, 16, 17 hour days. It was, you know, it's very long, tiring, but working with a great group of guys as well, like girls and guys, like, you know, just working all together to kind of really create, you know, some beautiful food, and some talented chefs as well who have moved on to open up their own places or head up, you know, some really good places as well. So you see a lot of talent there. But yeah, after working in Melbourne for the 3 years, I then went overseas. And then after, well, being overseas, I worked on a yacht, because that was the next stage. I had a few friends who had worked on yachts previously. And so I was like, oh, that, you know, sounds quite good. You know, get over there, experience something else, be on a yacht, cook what you want to cook, that kind of thing. So I ended up getting a job on a small yacht. It was privately owned by a Dutch family. They would only come, they came over for a long 6-week holiday trip over the summer. But apart from that, it was just a couple of weeks here and there as a family kind of trips. And we were docked in Antibes, which is on the southeast coast of France. But, you know, just a bit up is Cannes, a bit further up is Monaco. And then if you start going down, you go to Saint-Tropez. We ended up going over to Spain as well. So, you know, got to dock in some beautiful places there. Palma del Mallorca. Where else?
Well, can we go? Can we go back? No, yeah, that's okay. That's another story.
It is, isn't it?
And we could actually focus on people working for very rich people on yachts. Now, coming back, you said you worked in a chocolate shop in London?
Yeah, London. Right.
So how did you get into that?
So that was after the yacht.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, in Melbourne, when I was still working in Melbourne, I started doing 1 day a week at a pastry shop called Birch and Purchase. So they're on Chapel Street down there, and that's owned by a husband and wife again. That's Darren and Kath, and beautiful couple as well. And they, you know, they've been going for years already, but they'd really established like this beautiful patisserie. But in the patisserie as well, they did a lot of chocolate work. They had their own little chocolate room, so it was temperature controlled and everything, and, you know, just doing mainly kind of garnishes and things as well. But it was kind of, that was my real kind of first introduction to working with chocolate, because I'd done it before previously, but generally, you know, even on a pastry section and that, you're not really doing what I do now, which is kind of working with it properly, tempering it, molding it, decorating it that way. You kind of use it more as a base ingredient for cakes, mousses, other souffles, things like that. So there I kind of got a bit more of a hands-on experience of working with it, you know, in its proper form, which was really, really good. Like, you know, it was a fantastic experience. So even only doing that occasionally, but it kind of got the ball rolling in a sense, particularly for the chocolate aspect. So yeah, once I left Melbourne, went overseas, worked on the yacht. Once the season was over, after 7 months, the next stage was, all right, I'm going to go up to London. I'll move up there because I have family, you know, and I really wanted to get into pastry and bakery. So I ended up getting myself the job at Paul A. Young's, which is the chocolate shop there. So I did that 3 days a week. And then I also got myself a job at Bread Ahead, which was a bakery, still is a bakery now, at London Bridge, so Borough Market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, spent 2 days with them, 3 days chocolate, and it was a great little balance.
So how did you approach the company to say, well, Stu, I'm this person that you want?
Yeah, well,
how does that work?
It's like the majority of the hospitality industry. It's kind of just send off emails, and then you just go, look, I'm happy to work for you for free for X amount of time, or I'd love to come in and do a bit of what they call a stage. So, you know, you're going in, you're giving your time, but you're working alongside, you know, the people that work there. And generally, like, you know, if you can show, you know, that you've got the skills, you've got the commitment, then you know, there can be a job there. If a job's there, you know, it can be offered. So that's generally how it works. And then other times, you know, you can do a stage just so you can get into a well-established pace, just so you can kind of experience it. I know you hear of a lot of chefs and that just can go, like, you know, how they can afford it. They just go around and do stages around the world. So, you know, you could work, you could give yourself 3 months of yourself just to one restaurant. But, you know, if given the caliber of the restaurant, like, you can take a lot from it, but, you know, you gain a lot of experience as well. So it was just a matter of that. I was looking for some work. So I think probably about 4 or 5 different chocolatier places I just emailed off. It was coming into, I'm just trying to think what month it was coming into. I think it was close to Christmas time, or it was coming into more Christmas. So obviously a lot of places were very busy on production with that. But, you know, because I hadn't had a lot of chocolate experience before, so it was kind of like, oh, you know, the experience isn't there. We really don't want to take you on and having to train you, sort of thing, whilst we're going into this very busy period. But luckily enough, I was able to get through into Paul A. Young's. The head chocolatier there was an Australian guy as well, who'd been working over in the UK in Scotland for quite some time. So I think there was a little bit of a, you know, a connection there when he saw, you know, another Aussie was looking for a bit of work or wanting to come in.
Yeah.
So that was definitely like a nice little kind of fit. And then that's how I ended up getting, you know, I just offered myself, you know, once or twice a week. I was happy just to go in and just offer my time and be able to kind of learn from it. But then eventually that turned into, you know, a casual position.
Right. Well, my first experience of the word chocolatier was when we were in Paris, and that would have been in the 90s, late 90s, and then in Belgium, in Bruges, I saw the word chocolatier on the outside of some pretty wonderful shops. When we say the word chocolatier, and in the sense of a profession or professionalism in the creation of chocolates, what does actually the chocolatier mean?
I believe, like, for me, a chocolatier is someone who works with chocolate on a constant basis. It's like being a chef, being a baker, or anything like that. You're working with a particular set of skills. You're working with a particular ingredients, and you're able to kind of, you know, get the most out of that ingredient and produce something that's, you know, really, you know, of highest quality as well, to showcase the skills that you have. So for me, it's like, yeah, it's very, you know, it's not a term used much here in Australia, chocolatier. You know, even someone who works with chocolate, you kind of just think of the generic kind of chocolate names and that, or chocolate businesses that have been around for quite some time. So, like, it's still, yeah, it's still progressing. But I think for me, yeah, when I hear a chocolatier or someone like that, it just invokes that someone's working with chocolate. They're able to create some good masterpieces as well.
I'd say like a boutique.
Yeah, most definitely.
That's right. Well, there are a number of chocolate establishments around Australia that have established and can be found in a number of areas, but they're not at the high end in the sense of it's every chocolate's an experience. As a style of chocolatier, do you see a blend between presentation versus taste?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like everything, I think you can put a lot of effort into it, and like the end result still needs to taste good. Like you want to make it look as presentable as possible. And sometimes you can still, you don't have to put much color or something on a piece of chocolate. I mean, chocolate itself is, yeah, you know, it's quite colorless in a sense, but when you can kind of, you know, you can still make it look very nice, elegant as well, but then the taste also has to be there. So I think there is a big balance, because I mean, you can make something look really nice and colorful and really pop, but then when you eat it, you kind of go, oh, it's tasty, but I don't really know what flavor I'm trying, or things like that. So I think, and sometimes you can taste it as well. It's like, oh, that's a bit grainy, or, you know, it just doesn't taste as well as I thought it might. So I think, yeah, there is a high balance, like anything, like any of those professions as well. You need to kind of get the quality there as well as the final product, the, you know, the taste and everything has to be there as well.
Yeah. So from a person who has got no knowledge whatsoever of how you would take a concept through to something that's on a display.
Yep.
How do you take idea through, just to give us a sort of sense of what's involved in the development of a thought and then to a creation that's sitting there that someone can experience?
Yeah, definitely. So, like, it's I suppose that's the good thing about having kind of the cooking element behind me as well, and the chefing, is that sense of, like, you know, you work through structure. So it's like you think about taste, you think about mouthfeel, you think about flavor, texture as well as it being important. So you kind of want to incorporate those in what you do. So whether you add, you know, crunchy nuts or seeds or something to the chocolate, so you get like a nice smooth flavor, but then you also get, you know, a crunch as well. So it kind of, you know, they work together really well. Flavor wise, it's decoration. So it's like, what do I want it to look like, the final product? What color do I want it to be? Generally, you try and match the color with the flavor it's going to be. So at least you've got, you know, when you first visualize it, you still have a mental note of what you have. Sometimes, you know, when we do our chocolate boxes, we add a card there so you know what each flavor is. But sometimes when you look at it, you know, a lot of the time you can go, oh, it's green, you know, you can associate that with mint, or orange, you can associate it with orange. But, you know, we add more kind of layers to it as well. But it's another visual thing, is you want to look at it and be able to go, oh, that reminds me, you know, it relates to something of what it is as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you looking for in the perfect cacao bean to ensure that the base of your chocolate is sound?
Well, to be honest, I don't make the chocolate from scratch. I know it's, I use a French company called Valrhona. To me, they make some of the highest end chocolate in the world. So, I mean, they source their beans from all over the world. They do it very sustainably as well. They work very closely with their farmers, you know, with their communities. They've got a lot of programs in place that, you know, from the farmers themselves, from harvesting and everything, but then also in, you know, structure for the villages, building things like schools and, you know, educational, you know, aspects as well. So what they do is they source their beans from their farmers. They take it back to France. We actually, when we went over for a trip, a family trip, my wife and I, we went down and actually saw the factory down there in France, and it was amazing to see. But yeah, they source all their beans, they roast them all, and then they produce their chocolate. So I know, obviously, like anything else, is like the quality of the product that you use to start with will kind of dictate your quality of mm-hmm. the product you finish with, as long as in between your work, you work with it properly as well. Because mm-hmm. you can get some really good quality ingredients, you can muck it up in the middle, and then the end result isn't going to be that good either.
Yeah.
So, I mean, chocolate itself, yeah, it's very, from the bean aspect, like, you know, it's a very long journey before you even get it to, you know, its final form of just chocolate. When we get that, what I do is I'll melt that down and I temper it by hand, you know, so you get it into the right state that you want it, and then everything else is done. So we mold, you know, decoration of the molds, preparation of the molds to start with is a lengthy thing of polishing the molds with cotton just so they get a nice shine, decorating them with the colored cocoa butter, lining them with the chocolate just to get a nice shell, filling them with the ganache, and then capping again. So even with the truffles themselves, you know, it can take me 2, 3, even 4 days sometimes to produce. But chocolate itself, again, it's one of those things. You've got to start with a good quality ingredient. Otherwise, and work with it properly, know what you're doing with it. Mm. Otherwise, your end result, you can make it look as good as you want and it can look outstanding. But, you know, I could easily buy some baking chocolate from the supermarket and turn it into something that looks really nice, but then when you eat it, you don't get that same experience. You know that the quality isn't there because you can taste it. So
okay. Well, this is a terrible analogy, and there's not so much artistic work endeavour. Right. But I can tell you, if you go around to some coffee shops around Canberra, they might have a wonderful bean, but they're not doing too much to add value to that of bean course, once yeah. they've got it. I if mean, it's a very after. Simple analogy, yeah. but
it's no, but it completely like yeah. it resonates because chocolate is the same. Like it is a bean itself. Mm-hmm. It needs to be prepared. It needs to be fermented, roasted, and then worked with. Same with coffee. It's like, yeah, if you've got this really good quality bean to start with, but it's not looked after, then your yeah. end quality product is not going to be nice. So.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about your history. And just for everybody know, Stu has this wonderful establishment on Lonsdale Street, and at the end of our discussion, we might just give a heads up to the website that you can have a look at this wonderful. We're talking about how you create things. The wonderful images are there, but a little bit about the history of how you've landed in Lonsdale Street
in a
business with four walls and a front counter.
Yeah, definitely. Well, after being quite a bit of a story, I suppose, the way I got to Canberra for the second time after being here, 10 plus years ago. My wife now, I met her years and years ago at the other restaurant. And at the time she was married, she had a family, well, she had a little girl. So, we were friends then. We've always kept in touch and on and off, just, always had, a contact there. And it wasn't until I was in the UK and I was starting to settle myself down. I got a couple of jobs. So I was kind of tossing between whether I stick with going with chocolate full time or baking full time because, baking was another beautiful passion, and particularly working with some, artisan style kind of sourdoughs and things like that was amazing. And the baker I worked with is Justin Galletly, who used to work for St. John's Restaurant. Who produced like really famous donuts that are over there now. Anyway, so it was kind of tossing up between there, and then, one thing led to another and we got in contact, and, it was just, before I knew it, I was in Australia again because, I was coming home to her in a sense, and, she was in Canberra at the time. For study and things, and that's where she was based. But we kind of, at the start, we were going to come back, and it's like, all right, we'll stay here for a year or so, and then we'll move off. We're looking about going back to Newcastle way because she loves the beaches and being by the water and that. And then slowly but surely, as Canberra does, it grows, and particularly with people that aren't from Canberra originally, you can be an outsider and know that, there's a lot of stigma attached, or, you just get that, oh, Canberra, whatever. But after being here and living here as well, so I got myself, when I first moved back, I got a job at, which was now Sonoma, but it was Alderley's Bakery. So, because I had the bakery skills, there wasn't much in the way of chocolate. So, I did apply to a couple that were in the area, but didn't really get much of a response. So, I was like, all right, I'll go with bakery, which was fine. So, but while I was at bakery as well, I started tinkering with chocolates at home and kind of like, it was always there. It's like, oh, maybe that's the business I can go. That's where I can, that's where we can go next. So after being at the bakery for a while, even still at the bakery, I was doing some chockies at home, and then kind of went, all right, well, let's give it a go. We'll go to, a local market. So we ended up starting at the old bus depot, and slowly but surely, it was only, a week here, a week there sort of thing. But by the end of the year, we were going, or for the following year, it was like, we'll make it more of a regular appearance. And then, it kind of evolved from that. So I went from the bakery, I took a cafe job just to be a bit easier for the family, Monday to Friday sort of job. And after that, it was, still doing chocolates at home, and it kind of evolved that much that, I had to kind of stop doing what I was doing at the cafe and just focus on chocolates at home. So it kind of evolved from there, and then we got a demountable building, which we were able to put to the side of the house and get that all hooked up, electricity and water, and started producing in there. So that was a 12-meter by 3-meter space. So that slowly kind of got the ball rolling even more, did more markets and wholesale, things like that. And then it just got to a point, well, we're here, we're either going to stay at this kind of level and just kind of not taper off, but you just kind of get a bit stale, I suppose. Or the next step is looking for a shop. And that's what we did. We looked around and had a few options, but then we come across this one on Lonsdale Street, and it felt right. Felt like a good location to be. And then we opened up 20th of March last year.
Mm-hmm. It used to be a hairdresser's shop, and now it's turned into a beautiful artisan chocolatier shop.
Chocolatier.
Introduce that concept in a Canberra.
Of course.
And to recognise the quality of your work, I noticed on your webpage that in 2017 you were Champion Australian Small Producer Trophy, and in 2018 Best Chocolate Best in Class Award. Where was that?
Yeah, that was great. So that was they were both through the Rural Agricultural Society of Victoria. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things again, like you see like the little symbols that they have, little medallions that you see around and things like that. So it was like, oh, you know, we'll enter a couple of the chocolates in there just to see how we go. How it fares up, sort of thing. And yeah, ended up sending those off and got a couple of, well, the, what was it, the seven, I think it's the seven that I sent in. I got 5 gold, 1 silver, and 1 bronze. Mm-hmm. So that was a great encouragement to start with, like getting that, you know, come to us, and it was like, oh, you know, that's fantastic. And didn't think much else about it. And then they had a dinner evening, like a gala dinner that mm-hmm. they have on every night or every year, that they introduce the winners of awards and things. So it's like, oh, we thought, no, that'd be a good opportunity. Wife and I went down, you know, just as a bit of a, you know, get away for a couple of nights, go down to Melbourne, go check it out. And we were there at the gala dinner, and yeah, it came up that you know, they called our name for the, it was a small producer trophy, and couldn't believe it at all. Okay. That this little, you know, us, what we do, and this little production. And that was before we even had the shop, so that was just still kind of working from home.
Well, on just to finalise our chat today, I had the pleasure of interviewing your good self and others around the impact on small businesses on COVID-19. I think we covered off a fair bit there, but just from an artisan's perspective, how are you seeing that sector being coming out of COVID, or what are the impacts for them and artisans in the broader sense?
Yep.
that you're observing, not from, say, your business perspective, but yep. in a general sense, the artistic community, how's that coping in the middle of this pandemic, you think?
Yeah, well, you know, general aspects of it, I suppose, you know, how you got your kind of theatre artists and things like that, which I know would have a huge impact on them, like not being able to perform and things, not having people come in and watch them. I suppose, like for me, or even personally, but then I see a lot of artisans, even if they're creating things like sculpting, woodwork, things like that. But I hope it's still given them an opportunity. They can still work with their product. They can still produce things as well that, like, you know, I think even with like sales and stuff, like online and social media has been, you know, a huge boost as well. I hope, well, I see most of the time, I think if you can still work with your craft, you can still hone in on it. It can sometimes, you know, a bit of isolation can give you more influence, can kind of, you know, give you a different aspect on things so you can produce different things as well. So, yeah, I think I haven't, you know, I haven't really been in touch with, I don't really know many more artisans in the sense of outside of the hospitality industry, but I can assume like for ourselves as well, like, you know, it's a constant kind of, you have a constant passion, a constant drive to keep doing what you do to better yourself, you know, and to produce, you know, as much as you can, like as good a quality as you can, as you know you can, but then continue to, you know, do even better.
Now, just in summary, we talked about where you're located, yeah. but if someone wanted to have a look at what a chocolatier's product looks like,
yeah.
What's your web address?
So our web address is www.enigmafinechocolates. It's all one word, lowercase, and S on the end of chocolates.com.au. And we do have a shop there, but we also have a bit of a picture gallery that you can have a look at some
of
that stuff.
That's what I was getting at, because it's a wonderful site. And if you look for chocolatier in Canberra, you'll get the bog standard chocolate outlets, but you'll also find a little reference to Enigma. Have a look at there, Chris. It's a wonderful experience, and then you can decide what you want to do after that. For me, it's a wonderful place to visit. Now, we're going to finish our conversation today with a track from Kings of Leon, and it's called Closer. And just a very quick summary, why Closer?
Again, a big relation to my wife. Back in the day, back at our old restaurant that we used to work in together, this is a song I used to play every single Saturday evening after a shift, and it just had that connection that we have, and it's kind of grown into what we have now. So it's a very kind of, you know, very strong song between two of us as well.
Okay, Stu, thank you very much for coming in today. It's a pleasure to have you here, and I'm hoping that you might pick up on that suggestion of putting chocolatier in the reference.
I think we might have to now, definitely.
Well, I think so, because it gives it a reference point to the quality and the effort and the artistry that goes into the products that you are producing.
Definitely.
Thank you, Stu.
Thank you very much.